Being a ministry wife is a vocation without a job description. And let's be honest, sometimes it seems like ministry might be easier if we did have one. If you are a ministry wife like me and are looking for hope, perspective, and a little bit of practical advice regarding your role, you're in the right place. Hi, I'm Christine Hoover, author of How to Thrive as a Pastor's Wife. Welcome to the Ministry Wives Podcast, a production of the North American Mission Board. Join me as we hear from women from various ministry contexts, having authentic conversations about our shared joys and challenges, even the ones we're unsure we can talk about. No topic is off limits. Today, my guest is Melissa Swain. Melissa is a ministry widow who was married to her husband, Chris, for nearly 23 years until the Lord unexpectedly called him home in 2021. Chris was in the process of writing a book, which Melissa finished and saw published. She continues to attend and now works at the church they were serving at when Chris passed. Melissa lives in the Nashville, Tennessee area with her two children and their English bulldog. Melissa joins me today to talk about losing her husband and about the identity shift from being a pastor's wife to becoming a pastor's widow. She helps us to know how we can minister to widows in our churches, and she shares about the intentional ways her husband, Chris, discipled their kids that she is continuing after his death. Here, friends, is my conversation with Melissa Swain. It's my great privilege to welcome Melissa Swain to the podcast today. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I would love for you to introduce yourself and tell us about your family, what you're doing, where you are, all that good stuff.
My name is Melissa Swain. My kids and I live right outside of Nashville, and we have been here for about 10 years. Before that, we lived all over the South. My kids don't remember any of that, but my husband Chris and I did live all over the South, serving in all kinds of different ministry capacities. And so now it is just the kids and me, because Chris passed away very unexpectedly in 2021. So now I have a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old, and we are just doing this life the best that we can.
Yeah, and he was in a ministry position at your church when Yes. he died. Can you tell us about what he did, what his passions were in ministry?
Yeah, so, you know, I think if you've been in ministry very long, you've filled a lot of different roles and stepped into a lot of different Yes. shoes. So we started out in student ministry, which is where so many people start. And the Lord took us all kinds of places doing all kinds of things. But where he finally landed and what his absolute passion was, discipleship. And so he was the disciple-making pastor at our church, Long Hollow, right here outside of Nashville when he passed. And that was his sweet spot. That brought everything that he had been passionate about all through student ministry, all through groups ministry, young adults, all the things that we had done, that kind of like culminated into this perfect place for him to be able to see people grow in their faith of all ages.
Yeah. And is that a passion that you've shared with him, or did you kind of pick up what it was a passion of his and you kind of picked up on that, or what are your passions in ministry, I guess?
Well, we had always lived, I grew up in a large family. And so my parents discipled us without even knowing that's what they were doing. And Chris didn't come from a context like that in his family. And so that was something different for him. And I was like, oh, but that's kind of what you're supposed to do. And so he'd never learned those things any other way. And so that was something that we developed together in our own home. And then as we were looking, he was a reader, as I am. And so he was always looking for the right kind of book to show him how to do something or to tell him how to do something. And he couldn't find anything that really talked about how to disciple your kids, but that wasn't, you have to do these four things or else you're a failure. Yeah. Or if you don't, you know, play the guitar and have your own worship service at home, then you're not discipling your kids. And so the Lord really burdened him about that, and that there's a better way to teach families how to disciple their kids. And so that just kind of became something that he was super passionate about the last few years of his life.
Yeah. And it seems like he was at the right church for that, because I know Long Hollow is known kind of for a lot of discipleship resources with Robbie and Candy Gallaty there. So it sounds like it was a perfect fit for him.
It was the easiest ministry move we ever made. He was at Lifeway at the time when Robbie came to our church. We were already going to church there. And when Robbie asked him, hey, will you come and work for me and help me with this discipleship ministry? We kind of looked at each other and we were like, wait, that's too easy.
Yeah.
So it was a fantastic fit, I think, for all of us.
Yeah. How long were y'all married?
We were married almost 23 years.
23 years. Can you tell us a little bit about just that time of losing him? And I mean, yeah, we just want to kind of know your story, know him from what you can share about him.
Yeah. So Chris was, he was always very intentional. And so he knew he had this manuscript to write and to get finished. And so normally in July, that's our no month, that we say no to everything and we stay at home and just chill out and hang out together. And that had been our plan. But he said, you know what? I want to finish my manuscript. You guys have a thing to go to at your mom and dad's with your family. You guys go. I'll finish this manuscript. And then when you get home, we'll be done with everything and we can really focus in on our family time and have a good time. So I was like, great. We're going to go play and have fun. You stay here and work and potty train the new puppy. And we'll all enjoy that.
Right.
So we left Chris and the brand new puppy at home, and we went to my mom and dad's. And that is where we were when we got the call that Chris had collapsed. He'd gone out to get the mail, took the puppy with him, and a neighbor found him by the mailbox. They started CPR. 911 was called. They got his heart and breathing back, but he never regained consciousness after that. And we spent several days in the hospital trying to figure out like what's going on, what happened. But honestly, we never really got answers for what happened or why it happened. But that was where the Lord took us. Like it was unmistakable that God was calling him home, and that we had to let him go.
How old was he when he died?
He was 47.
That's so young. So young. And that, I know there's a lot of components to this, and we could talk about different aspects of grief and what this has meant. I'm sure you're still discovering new things that this means for you 2 years, 2.5 years later. But one thing that I wanted to ask you about was how this has impacted your identity in terms of being a pastor's wife, because it was so sudden. It's not like, oh, we're making a decision to retire and we know this is coming and we've had our whole life, you know, to do this. And this was unexpected. And suddenly you're thrust into this new life of being a widow, and your husband no longer works for the church. You don't have that same connection, but you still go to the church. Can you kind of help us understand just some of the dynamics at play for you in that?
There are so many, and really I'm still navigating all of this, and still trying to figure it out as I go. And I am so grateful and so thankful that our pastor and our pastor's wives, all of them actually have still included me in all of the things that we did together before. Because, I mean, there's a statistic that says widows lose 75% of their support system.
Wow.
And to think about that is astounding, just for anybody in the general sense. But when you are connected to most of the people you're connected to because of the ministry you're involved in with your husband, and then he's suddenly not there anymore, all of those connections either are extremely fragile or they're just gone. And so that is really difficult to navigate. And I understand the other statistic that is 50% of widows leave their church. And the reason I think they do is because those connections that they had there are very fragile or gone. And so their person that they walk in with, that they sit with, that they go to classes with, that they do things with, is not there anymore. And so that makes it really difficult to continue to be involved there in the same context with the same people around you, but you're not the same anymore.
Oh, I see. When you use that word fragile a few times, what do you mean? The relationship was fragile or is fragile?
I think that a lot of people, like I, just like any pastor's wife, I knew people because they knew Chris.
Right.
Like you can go to an event and you're there with your husband and people know him. They know who he is and you're kind of just there with him sometimes. They don't really know you. Right. And so you meet people because you're with him. And right. So that's not necessarily deep relationships that you develop right away. There are some that develop into that. But even the people who you know, they don't know what to do with you anymore. Mm. And that's not bad. That's just a fact that you're not the pastor's wife anymore. And so they don't know how to approach you. They don't know what to say to you. They don't know how to talk to you or to even sometimes be in the same room with you because it's uncomfortable for them. It's uncomfortable for me too. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing with this either. Yeah. And so those relationships, but what I mean by fragile is that it doesn't take very much for them to go away.
And it's interesting what you said, that you are different too, which makes complete sense. But you're relating to people you're a changed person because of what you're experiencing. Yeah. And so I'm wondering how we as churches, and this would be great, just speaking of ministry wives, how can we in our churches be aware of and sensitive to widows that are in our churches?
I think the first thing that really shocked me about widowhood was learning that the average age that women become widows is 59.
Wow.
And that seems really young because, I mean, I grew up in church. We had a widow's banquet, which is fantastic. But in my mind, a widow was someone who was old and frail and, needed someone to come mow her lawn because she was physically incapable.
Yeah.
And that's not truth. I mean, yes, there are those people. And yes, we can care for them by doing those things. But I needed somebody to mow my lawn because I physically didn't have the capacity to do one more thing. Mm-hmm. I needed somebody to mow my lawn, not because my son couldn't go do it, because he could have, but because I didn't have the brain power or the energy or the capacity to even tell him, hey, go mow the lawn. And he was a teenager, so of course he's not going to see the lawn that needs to be mowed and go do it.
Yeah.
And I think the hardest thing is to shift from being someone who does the ministry to someone who needs the ministry. Mm. And that is, it's beautiful in that there are people who are reaching out and who are taking care of things and who are, you know, still saying, hey, I'll come mow your lawn for you if you need that. But it's every time I ask for one of those things, which is really, really hard and I hate doing, or someone offers something specific and I accept their offer, it is a reminder of why I have to accept that offer. Mm. And I think what really has been helpful is that instead of saying, because I've done this, we've all done this, let me know what I can do for you. what can I do for you? How can I help you? Which is a legitimate and valid question. A lot of times I don't know. I don't know what I need. I don't know how you can help. But if someone says, hey, can I pick your kid up and take them to this thing? Yes, you can. Hey, I'm at the grocery store. Do you need toilet paper or bananas or apples? Yes, I do. When it has been the most helpful for me, when people are very specific, letting me know, hey, this is within my capacity to do for you. Please let me do it. And then I can say yes to those things.
Yeah, that's helpful. What has most helped you in this? I kind of think of it as like an in-between. You're not the pastor's wife anymore, but you still very much, that's your life. You're used to that.
Yeah.
So what, in terms of being the pastor's wife, what was most helpful for you in, as you've navigated this change or the shift in the way you approach or relate to the church?
Still really, honestly, still being treated as a pastor's wife by my church pastors, by the other people on staff, that them still understanding that that's still my brain. That's still my reflex, my knee-jerk reaction. And that just because I don't have my husband here to like say, hang on, hold on a second. I have an idea about maybe how this could work, because we all do that. That even though he's not still here, that I still have something valuable to give.
So you said they're inviting you, that when the pastor's wives get together, you're going to those things. Is that good and you enjoy that, or is that sometimes hard?
Yes.
Both.
Yes. All of it. I find that there are so many things now that it's the both and.
Oh, yeah.
Is it hard or is it good? Yes. All of it. And depending on the day, it might be more hard than it is good. But I still want to be included, and I still want to be involved, even if I get to the day and I'm like, I can't do it today.
Yeah. Yeah, like you, them giving you the decision versus people deciding. Almost like, yes, you're not on the roll anymore, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But you get to decide that rather than others deciding it for you.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's huge. You know, I've had people say, well, I didn't know what to say, so I didn't call or I didn't text. I have a few people that I've lovingly, because I know them well enough, and I've said, I don't know what to say either. Mm-hmm. So it's okay that you don't know what to say, but it's never wrong to say, hey, I love you and I'm praying for you.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't know anything else to say, that's enough. That's awesome.
That's helpful. So where are you now? Where would you say you are now in the process of grief and your kids? You mentioned to me earlier you're homeschooling your kids and working. Mm-hmm. And so I would love just like snapshot of where you are now, 2.5 years later.
That's a really good question. I have, just like many of you, I have kids who are polar opposites of one another. I think the Lord did that to keep me on my toes and to keep me moving forward, because my kid, who is like me, us introverts, we would just introvert all the time and never leave our home and watch tons of stuff on Netflix and read our books and be happy to exist without the outside world. And then my extrovert child drags me all the places, to all the activities and all the things. And I have to get out of bed every day because that kid needs me to extrovert. And I have to do that.
Yeah. That might be a gift. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and one of my kids is very quiet and very stoic, and the other wears their emotions on their sleeves, and you never have to wonder what they're thinking. And we talk about Chris in our home We laugh about, oh my goodness, do you remember when this happened? And those things are a little bit easier now than they were. But sometimes it's still really difficult in the middle of something, because I find that they're kids, they're teenagers. They don't remember as much as I do. And they don't necessarily miss Chris the same way I do, which they shouldn't. It's completely different for them. But, you know, my son is playing football for the first time this year. He has no idea how many high school football games his dad and I attended together over our 20 plus years of ministry together. He doesn't know that his dad would hold up that fence at the edge of the field, because if he didn't, it would fall down. He was certain. And so, like, when he goes out on that field to play, he doesn't register that his dad's not standing on that fence. Mm-hmm. But I do.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Each milestone comes with new grief, it sounds like, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And like our counselor told me, she said, your kids will have to re-grieve at every stage as they grow. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Our son turned 16 and he's driving and it's awesome and wonderful. But at the same time, man, his dad would have loved to see that.
Yeah. I'm so sorry for your loss. And he sounds like, from everything I've heard about him, just a very intentional, even the things you're saying, it's like he was so thoughtful and intentional about things.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Or tell
yes.
us, just tell us about him.
He was far more intentional than I ever was. He was also the fun parent, which, you know, my daughter has started calling me a fun sponge. Because she says I just soak up all the fun in the room and don't allow anybody to have any fun. I'm like, yeah,
oh, wow.
That's me.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks. That's a 12-year-old for you. And my extrovert, you know, she's sure, let's do all the fun things. You know, it is, it's hard to be intentional with my kids, but also have the responsibilities of two parents.
Yeah.
When that was not the context we started out with or were used to, or even made a decision for that to be the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Chris was very intentional. He took each of our kids on a trip when they turned 10. And he had just taken Honor on her trip a few months before he passed. So, you know, we did the fun things at home, like family game nights, and he was always the one to initiate them because me, the fun sponge, no, I don't want to play that game. No, I hate Monopoly. I don't want to play.
Yeah.
But he was very intentional about making sure we had good quality family time together, no matter what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things he was intentional about, and you've talked about this, his passion for disciple making, but he was very, very passionate about that in your home with your children. Mm-hmm. And I love that. In fact, he wrote a book. You mentioned earlier he was writing. He had almost finished. I think you finished mm-hmm. it, right?
Yes.
The book. And the book is called Write It on Their Hearts, Practical Help for Discipling Your Kids. And is just kind of what he was doing with your own children, right?
Yes.
So I just kind of, and I'm, at, well, first let me ask, are there things that he started that you've continued with your kids?
Yes. And in fact, you know, I had most of this manuscript when he passed. In the Lord's goodness, Chris had finished most of it, done a lot of the edits that the editor had asked for, and sent them off the day that he collapsed.
Oh.
Like it was, I started looking back through his emails and I was like, oh, okay.
Wow.
All right. And then we had already together created a few of the tools in the back of the book. And so because I had those, even in the midst of, I don't even know what tomorrow looks like, I just have to survive today, I was able to pick up this tool and even remember what we'd put in this book and just do the next thing, which was also not letting my kids forget what their dad's passion was and show them and be able to point out to them God's goodness, even in the middle of all the gross, yucky stuff.
It's really amazing. It's really, if you think about it, almost like his final wishes. You know, this is what I would want for my kids, and it's written in book form for other people as well. And what a legacy that his kids can read, you know, if they pick, I don't know if they've read it yet, but to read it and go, this was my dad's heart. And that and I hope that that will continue on with, if they have children too. I'd love to ask you about some of those things, just for the listener, how we can disciple our own kids. And so can you just kind of talk to us? I'm going to ask you a few, just a few different areas. One is just, how do we teach our kids to read the Bible?
That seems to be one that parents find them almost the most difficult, not quite, but almost the most difficult. And it is because I think a lot of us didn't know how to read the Bible.
I
grew up in a church context. I was always told, hey, you should have a quiet time. You should read your Bible. Well, I could pick it up and read it, but that didn't mean that I knew what to do with that. And so teaching our kids to read the Bible is about much more than teaching them how to read the words on the page. It's about teaching them how to take it in and digest that. And part of that is letting them see us reading the Bible, because if they don't see us doing it, then they don't really understand why they should be doing it. Then when we start talking with our kids, even when they're little bitty, hey, I read this in the Bible today, and do you know what I learned from that? Verbally applying God's word to them, over them, even when they're little, or when they're older. Hey, what are you reading? How can I help you understand something? What is that saying to you? Teaching them as we go how to really study the scripture, digest it, and they're older, giving them tools to help them do that. That has been something that I've seen the fruit of in our family, and I know that other people can do that too.
What about prayer? Is a lot of what you're saying is to model these things? Or are there specific tools that you've taught your kids about how to pray on their own?
Yeah, we also, you know, a lot of us are intimidated by prayer, because like I grew up in the church when you prayed, you had to use certain fancy words. And, you know, it was just kind of implied that when you talk to God, you have to be super formal. And I don't want my kids to feel that way.
Yeah.
I want them to feel like, hey, this is a conversation that I'm having with God. And sometimes it means that I don't say a lot. Sometimes it means that I just sit there and say, God, I don't know what to do, and I don't know what to say. And so praying aloud, modeling prayer for them, letting them see you in your own prayer time, that is part of it. But also teaching them that we can ask God for things. Maybe we shouldn't ask God, like my daughter did one time, to change my mind about making them tear down a sheet fort that they had made in the living room. That's a little manipulative. We don't want to go there. But we can, teaching them, hey, we can really take our burdens to the Lord. We can really talk to him about the things that are bothering us, and to do it with them. The book has some really great tools in there about how to teach our kids to ask, seek, and knock. How the Lord's Prayer really models that for us. And because we don't want to teach our kids what to say. We don't want them to have a formula. We want them to know how to talk to God.
That's good. That's good. I mean, that you've said on both of these, Bible reading and prayer, of modeling. And a lot of times what I do is I have time with the Lord on my own. You know, I don't let my kids see that. I might talk about it over dinner, what we're reading, but they haven't seen me doing that. Mm-hmm. So I like that idea of letting them interrupt. I mean, almost like being interruptible, even in your time with the Lord.
I used to think that it wasn't honoring God if I wasn't like off by myself, and like I had to do it during nap time when they were little, or before they wake up, or after they go to bed. And I think that God honors those interruptions. Mm-hmm. When we are modeling this for our kids, and even though we may be interrupted 17 times for trivial things, and you know, to referee an argument or to open a granola bar or whatever it is that we're doing for our kids, I think God honors that in a different way than we think he might.
Yes. Yeah, I just think it would be make such a difference to have seen that in my own parents. And I, you know, just that that's important to them, and that that's a party. And I knew that they did it, but it was private. And so anyway, one of the chapters that I found really, really interesting in the book is teaching our kids how to rest.
Yeah.
And I think that is not something that I've often thought about in discipling my kids. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So we're not good at rest.
No.
Are we? No. Even though I'm an introvert who would prefer to stay in my house all the time, I'm still not good at rest. I'm going to be doing something. I'm going to have a project to do. I'm going to have a task that I'm focused on. And God gave us a command to rest, I think, because he knew that if he didn't, we wouldn't do it.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Even though he gave us a command, we don't always do it. But yes.
That's right. But like, he modeled it for us. He created everything in 6 days, and then he modeled rest for us. And then in the Ten Commandments, he gave us the command to rest on the Sabbath. And so if we take God's commands seriously, which we should, and if we take his example seriously, which we should, then rest should be important to us. Now, rest to me does not look the same as it does to probably anyone else. And rest to my kids doesn't look the same as it does to me or even to each other. But when we teach our kids to rest, not just physically, but emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, then we're teaching them really to rest in the Lord and to trust in him and to honor the fact that he told us to do this. And when we obey him, he blesses that. Mm-hmm. So teaching that is hard. It's probably the hardest one to teach because it's the hardest one to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, you have to make a plan. You have to prioritize it, because if you don't, you just won't do it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I have started doing is I'll take my calendar and I'll do a couple months at a time. And on certain days, I'll just write, nope. Nope. And so that gives me the option when I, you know, am invited to do something or an activity pops up. I look at that and say, oh, that's a nope day. Mm. So I'm only going to do something on that day if it provides rest or refreshment for me in some way. Mm. Like maybe our friends invite us to go to the lake with them. Well, that is restful and refreshing for my soul.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say yes to that. But if I hadn't blocked that day, I wouldn't have the option to do that.
That's really good. I like that a lot. I think I just think about that as a single mom, like rest. And a lot of pastors' wives they can't relate to exactly the single mom thing, but just the busyness of there's always something to do. If you're a single mom, there's always something to do. And so how do you do that, particularly as a single mom?
It's hard. It's also hard because my personality is that I have to, everything has to be done. And
before you can, you know,
the moms and, you know, the moms in the room, we have this mantra, you know, like, if I don't do it, no one else does it, right. You know, and we become martyrs in that sense. But truly now I'm in a position where if I don't do it, there is no one else to do it. Mm-hmm. And so I have had to adjust my priorities. Mm-hmm. I've had to, decide that it's really okay if the laundry doesn't get done today. Mm-hmm. And you know, things like that. I want my kids to be cared for and know that they're loved and they're fed, you know, like
right.
We have groceries in the house. It may not be what you want, but you can eat. But there are some days that even for myself, I have to tell my kids, hey, go play video games with your friends. Go hang out with your buddies. Go do whatever. I'll be in my room if you need me. And by the way, please don't need me for anything.
Yeah.
It's really hard. And I know that, you know, Chris traveled a lot. I have friends who have husbands who travel a lot. In ministry, you do a lot of the parenting on your own because our husbands are gone early on Sunday mornings and they don't come home until late and they have events and they have things that they have to do. But there was always that mental note of when he gets home,
yeah,
I can take a breath. Or when this event is over, I'll have him back, yeah. You know, like he'll be home. Or when the trip is done, when the business trip is over, when the conference is over or whatever he's gone for, when that comes home, I can have a minute. And that doesn't happen anymore. And so I'm still not very good at taking those breaks for myself and saying, hey, I'm done. I can't do this, but I have to. And I have to not feel guilty about that.
Yeah. Well, that really kind of leads me to the last question I would ask you is just, I would imagine you've learned new things about God specifically through widowhood and being a single mm-hmm. mom. So what would you say that you've learned about him and who he is through your current experience?
So many things. But one of the things that keeps popping up is that he hasn't forgotten me. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it is easy to feel forgotten because most people assume, oh, after the first year, you're fine. Everything's good. You've done all the first things. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the mentality of a lot of people surrounding widowhood. You've done the firsts, everything else will be easy. Mm-mm. The second Father's Day was harder than the first one. Everything new that my kids do is a first. And it's not like I want to walk around waving a flag like, hey, this is hard for me, because I don't. And I don't want to put that on anyone else or even on my kids. But sometimes it's really easy to be in a room and to feel like no one knows how hard it is to be there. Mm-hmm. Just to be there. Not even just participate.
Yeah.
And so yesterday was one of those days that it was just really hard to be in the room that I was in. And a friend texted me and she said, hey, the Lord brought you to my mind. And I'm thinking about you and praying for you. Hmm. And that reminded me that I don't have to wave a flag and say, hey, don't forget me. Mm-hmm. Because he hasn't. And for the people who are important in my life, they haven't. Mm-hmm. And even the people that I don't see often or talk to a lot, he still brings me to their mind and they still pray for me.
I love that. He sees. Yeah. Hasn't forgotten. Thank you for being willing to share that with us. I know, I mean, we don't know each other and this is going out to whoever listens, but I think it's super helpful. I think we need to hear that perspective and remember the people in our lives who are hurting and suffering and know that we have an opportunity. And this may, you know, I could be in your shoes tomorrow and to know that the God is faithful and he is good and he sees. So yeah. I really appreciate your willingness to share your story with us and to share your husband with us and the book. I want to remind everyone, the book is Write It on Their Hearts, Practical Help for Discipling Your Kids. Mm-hmm. And I have a copy of it and it is very, it says practical. It's very practical.
Yeah. So
this is, would be helpful for you in what you're doing with your kids. So thank you, Melissa, for joining us today. Ladies, if you are a woman who leads in ministry, whether you're on staff or in a volunteer capacity, I would love to invite you to join me for the first National Women's Evangelism Conference in Alpharetta, Georgia on April 8th and 9th next year. I know this event will encourage and equip you to create a culture of evangelism in your ministry. Register today and make plans to join us. Visit namevangelism.com/women-conference or visit the link in the show notes for all the details. Can't wait to see you there.